Welcome back. We're in the chapter, the triple transformation, in the Life Divine, chapter 25. The emergence of the soul in nature is key to its fulfillment, to the fulfillment of the cosmic enterprise. As the soul grows and evolves from its essence, from the state of being an entity, into a powerful agent able to act upon and through the gathered instruments of body, life, and mind, it can increasingly have an impact upon the world that it inhabits. So the soul brings the good, the true, the beautiful into flower upon the earth. As it stations itself at the level of the body can itself become a vehicle of harmony, of beauty. At the level of the heart, of the vital energies, love, amity, concord, progress, adventurous joy can manifest. When the soul impacts the mind, then there is clarity, there is lucidity, there is the search for what is true, a setting aside of unimportant baubles, and a real search for the hidden reality. But the soul does not come to the front all at once. It is an eonic endeavor. Let's take the last sentence of the last paragraph that we read. It is by the coming forward of this true monarch and his taking up of the reins of government that there can take place a real harmonization of our being and our life. So this soul, with its power, need not be stationed only at one or the other element, but can assume mastery, sovereignty, of the whole amalgam of our entire natural being. So the soul can dominate the thought, purify the vital energies, uplift and plasticize the body's capacities, and bring them into a harmony so that they can work together for still farther projects. So we'll take it from here, as Sri Aurobindo is describing the emergence of this psychic being, which represents to nature the psychic entity within. A first condition of the soul's complete emergence is a direct contact in the surface being with the spiritual reality. Because it comes from that, the psychic element in us turns always towards whatever in phenomenal nature seems to belong to a higher reality and can be accepted as its sign and character. So if the soul is to come completely forward, then it can't simply work through the intermediaries to contact the true being of Satchit-Ananda. It is itself a soul spark of this Satchit-Ananda, but must make a primary, a definite contact with that. At first, it seeks this reality through the good, the true, the beautiful, through all that is pure and fine, and high and noble. But although this touch, through outer signs and characters, can modify and prepare the nature, it cannot entirely or most inwardly and profoundly change it. For such an inmost change, the direct contact with the reality itself is indispensable, since nothing else can so deeply touch the foundations of our being and stir it, or cast the nature by its stir, into a ferment of transmutation. So the soul's influence in mind, life, and body changes, modifies, influences the equipment, but does not fundamentally transform it. For that to happen, for there to be a thorough reworking, a radical change, remember, getting to the root of things is what is radical. And what is radical for us is being in contact with that spiritual reality. Mental representations, emotional and dynamic figures have their use and value. Truth, good, and beauty are in themselves primary and potent figures of the reality, and even in their forms, as seen by the mind, as felt by the heart, as realized in the life, can be lines of an ascent. But it is in a spiritual substance and being of them and of itself that that which they represent has to come into our experience. The soul may attempt to achieve this contact mainly through the thinking mind as intermediary and instrument. It puts a psychic impression on the intellect and the larger mind of insight and intuitional intelligence and turns them in that direction. At its highest, the thinking mind is drawn always towards the impersonal. In its search, it becomes conscious of a spiritual essence, an impersonal reality which expresses itself in all these outward signs and characters, but is more than any formation or manifesting figure. It feels something of which it becomes intimately and invisibly aware, a supreme truth, a supreme good, a supreme beauty, a supreme purity, a supreme bliss. It bears the increasing touch, less and less impalpable and abstract, more and more spiritually real and concrete, the touch and pressure of an eternity and infinity, which is all this that is and more. There is a pressure from this impersonality that seeks to mold the whole mind into a form of itself. At the same time, the impersonal secret and law of things becomes more and more visible. The mind develops into the mind of the sage. At first, the high mental thinker, then the spiritual sage who has gone beyond the abstractions of thought to the beginnings of a direct experience. As a result, the mind becomes pure, large, tranquil, impersonal. There is a similar tranquilizing influence on the parts of life, but otherwise the result may remain incomplete, for the mental change leads more naturally towards an inner status and an outer quietude. But poised in this purifying quietism, not drawn like the vital parts towards a discovery of new life energies, does not press for a full dynamic effect on the nature. So, the soul, through the various instruments, will try to contact that great spiritual reality. The soul, using the mind, conceives of this impersonal, essential being that it tries to reach, sees it as a truth, sees it as a good or a beauty, feels the pressure of that upon itself, as if there is an impersonal will, a will of the impersonal, that draws like a magnet or presses itself into the aspiring soul through the mind until it feels. And so as one lives, exists under the influence of that reality, it pours itself into the mind, and you have the birth of the philosopher who raises his being to the level of being a sage, but a sage in the mind. And then a spiritual sage, one who begins to have gone beyond thought into the actual figuring experience of that. So you're leaving behind the mere philosopher and arriving at somebody who is both a practitioner, an experiencer of that supreme reality. And of course, we can look through many examples, but even if we turn to the West, we see in the Neoplatonic thought of Plotinus, just such a sage who cast into beautiful form a kind of Platonic mysticism that the One has manifested here in a sense. One can experience it. And his greatest disciples saw Plotinus on several occasions enter into deep rapture where he was taken into that. He experienced it. And they could witness the impact of that experience upon his human personality to see what it did to him. And that has been recorded for a couple of thousand years and has been a source of inspiration. So even in the West, there are plentiful examples of how the mind, lifting itself up into that reality, leads to a changed life. And yet, the mind's touch of that reality might influence the life parts, but cannot dynamically change them. They remain largely as they were. This brilliant light is thrown upon them or is visible in them momentarily, but it does not change the structure. He continues, a higher endeavor through the mind does not change this balance. For the tendency of the spiritualized mind is to go on upwards. And since above itself, the mind loses its hold on forms, it is into a vast formless and featureless impersonality that it enters. The mind is not an infinite agency. It requires forms in which to work. And when it enters into the formless, into the featureless, into the vastitude of that reality of Sat, it blanks out. Sri Aurobindo continues, it becomes aware of the unchanging self, the sheer spirit, the pure bareness of an essential existence, the formless infinite, and the nameless absolute. This culmination can be arrived at more directly by tending immediately beyond all forms and figures, beyond all ideas of good or evil or true or false or beautiful or unbeautiful, to that which exceeds all dualities, to the experience of a supreme oneness, infinity, eternity, or other ineffable sublimation of the mind's ultimate and extreme percept of self or spirit. So to get to that which exceeds all definition, which is indeterminate, And this, of course, is Jnana Yoga. A spiritualized consciousness is achieved, and the life falls quiet. The body ceases to need and to clamor. The soul itself merges into the spiritual silence. But this transformation through the mind does not give us the integral transformation. The psychic transmutation is replaced by a spiritual change on the rare and high summits. But this is not the complete divine dynamization of nature. So the psychic transformation means that the soul's influence and impact upon the mind, life, and body is felt throughout. It does not radically transform the nature. But this spiritual transformation also, through the mind, does not give us the integrality that we seek, because all must be one. That reality is one. We call it Sat-Chit-Ananda, but it is one reality. We must forge what seem to be the disparate elements here into a living, actual harmony. So he hints that the psychic and the spiritual both are not capable of affecting that integral transformation. But he's only part of the way through examining this. Let's go farther. So the first was through the mind, what we would call Jnana Yoga. A second approach made by the soul to the direct contact is through the heart. This is its own more close and rapid way, because its occult seat is there, just behind in the heart center, in close contact with the emotional being in us. It is consequently through the emotions that it can act best at the beginning, with its native power, with its living force of concrete experience. So if we're looking at the inner geography of things, although the soul can be felt at any level supporting nature, whether in the mind or in the heart or even in the body, here, not the front, not the emotional heart center, but behind is the center of the psyche, and it radiates from its hidden seat, occult seat there, outwards. This stationing of the soul behind the emotional being means that for most people, the best practical method of reaching into union with the divine is through the development of this. This is something that Sri Ramakrishna enjoined upon his disciples as well. It is, Sri Aurobindo writes, through a love and adoration of the all-beautiful and all-blissful, the all-good, the true, the spiritual reality of love, that the approach is made. The aesthetic and emotional parts join together to offer the soul, the life, the whole nature to that which they worship. This approach through adoration can get its full power and impetus only when the mind goes beyond impersonality to the awareness of a supreme personal being. Then all becomes intense, vivid, concrete. The heart's emotion, feeling, spiritualized sense reach their absolute. An entire self-giving becomes possible, imperative. Clearly, he's talking here about the development of bhakti yoga. And clearly, in these first two steps that he describes, seeking that spirituality through the mind, reaching the impersonal, seeking that divine reality as a person through the heart, are part and parcel of his own development. His first realization, the Brahmic Nirvana in 1908, followed by his discovery of his beloved Vasudeva everywhere as he sat in the Alipur jail in 1910, both are figured here in these paragraphs. We continue. The nascent, that means coming into being, the nascent spiritual man makes his appearance in the emotional nature as the devotee, the bhakta. If, in addition, he becomes directly aware of his soul and its dictates, unites his emotional with his psychic personality, and changes his life and vital parts by purity, God ecstasy, the love of God and men and all creatures, into a thing of spiritual beauty, full of divine light and good, he develops into the saint and reaches the highest inner experience and most considerable change of nature proper to this way of approach to the divine being. But for the purpose of an integral transformation, this too is not enough. There must be a transmutation of the thinking mind and all the vital and physical parts of consciousness in their own character. So we cannot rest simply at the attainment of sainthood. We must press beyond. It's good, it's very good, it is not enough. This larger change can be partly attained by adding to the experiences of the heart a consecration of the pragmatic will, which must succeed in carrying with it, for otherwise it cannot be effective, the adhesion of the dynamic vital part which supports the mental dynamis and is our first instrument of outer action. So we've come to Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, and now Karma Yoga. This consecration of the will in works proceeds by a gradual elimination of the ego will and its motive power of desire. The ego subjects itself to some higher law and finally effaces itself, seems not to exist, or exists only to serve a higher power or a higher truth, or to offer its will and acts to the divine being as an instrument. The law of being and action, or the light of truth which then guides the seeker, may be a clarity or power or principle which he perceives on the highest height of which his mind is capable, or it may be a truth of the divine will which he feels present and working within him or guiding him by a light or a voice or a force or a divine person or presence. In the end, by this way, one arrives at a consciousness in which one feels the force or presence acting within and moving or governing all the actions, and the personal will is entirely surrendered or identified with that greater truth will, truth power, or truth presence. A combination of all these three approaches, the approach of the mind, the approach of the will, the approach of the heart, creates a spiritual or psychic condition of the surface being and nature in which there is a larger and more complex openness to the psychic light within us and to the spiritual self or the Ishvara, to the reality now felt above and enveloping and penetrating us. In the nature, there is a more powerful and many-sided change, a spiritual building and self-creation, the appearance of a composite perfection of the saint, the selfless worker, and the man of spiritual knowledge. So, all the parts of our nature, then, can be touched by the soul and opened to the self. And these three states can coexist. We need not make a selection. We must be all. We must be the saint. We must be the karma yogin. We must be the jnanin, the knower of the divine. But for this change to arrive at its widest totality and profound completeness, the consciousness has to shift its center and its static and dynamic position from the surface to the inner being. It is there that we must find the foundation for our thought, life, and action. For to stand outside on our surface and to receive from the inner being and follow its intimations is not a sufficient transformation. One must cease to be the surface personality and become the inner person, the Purusha. But this is difficult. First, because the outer nature opposes the movement and clings to its normal, accustomed poise and externalized way of existence. And in addition, because there is a long way from the surface to the depths in which the psychic entity is veiled from us, and this intervening space is filled with a subliminal nature and nature movements, which are not by any means all of them favorable to the completion of the inward movement. And indeed, some have vested interests to oppose, delay, subvert, deny such a growth of the soul into dominance in the nature. It means they would have to give up their own fiefdoms and admit the rule of this greater monarch. So from the soul, from the psychic essence or entity, to the surface being, there's all this dangerous subliminal to survey and understand and to bring into harmony with the urge of the emerging soul power. The outer nature has to undergo a change of poise, a quieting, a purification, and fine mutation of its substance and energy by which the many obstacles in it rarefy, drop away, or otherwise disappear. It then becomes possible to pass through to the depths of our being, and from the depths so reached, a new consciousness can be formed, both behind the exterior self and in it, joining the depths to the surface. So this is not simply a retreat to the inmost caverns of our being, where lies the soul essence, but a dwelling of the soul, a coming forth of that power, to take over command of the outer rooms, to live all the way to the porch of the house. There must grow up within us, or there must manifest a consciousness more and more open to the deeper and the higher being, more and more laid bare to the cosmic self and power, and to what comes down from the transcendence, turned to a higher peace, permeable to a greater light, force, and ecstasy, a consciousness that exceeds the small personality and surpasses the limited light and experience of the surface mind, the limited force and aspiration of the normal life consciousness, the obscure and limited responsiveness of the body. So, not simply in touch occasionally with the soul within, but becoming that primary reality, open to the heights, open to the transcendent light as it wishes to descend, widened until one is commensurate with the world soul, with the self of all, with that greater peace, with that enforced purity, then the small personality begins to attenuate, and the real being can live in commonalty with all. Oneness. So at once, both the inner and the higher, the larger, and in that enlarged consciousness, a deepened consciousness. Even before the tranquilizing purification of the outer nature has been effected, or before it is sufficient, one can still break down the wall, screening our inner being from our outer awareness by a strong force of call and aspiration, a vehement will or violent effort, or an effective discipline or process. But this may be a premature movement and is not without its serious dangers. So, calling the peace, tranquilizing the being, lending light to it, bringing purity into it, probably the better way. But one can try, as it were, to take the kingdom of heaven by force. But it's dangerous. In entering within, one may find oneself amidst a chaos of unfamiliar and supernormal experiences to which one has not the key, or a press of subliminal or cosmic forces, subconscient, mental, vital, subtle, physical, which may unduly sway or chaotically drive the being, encircle it in a cave of darkness, or keep it wandering in a wilderness of glamour, allurement, deception, or push it into an obscure battlefield full of secret and treacherous and misleading or open and violent oppositions. Beings and voices and influences may appear to the inner sense and vision and hearing, claiming to be the divine being or his messengers or powers and godheads of the light or guides of the path to realization, while in truth they are of a very different character. So if one has an inordinate ambition, this rash insistence that I will go now, I'm going to break free of all trammels and find my way into this deeper experience, you throw yourself into a field where you're subject to all of these forces. If there is too much egoism in the nature of the seeker, or a strong passion, or an excessive ambition, vanity, or other dominating weakness, or an obscurity of the mind, or a vacillating will, or a weakness of the vital force, or an unsteadiness in it, or want of balance, he is likely to be seized on through these deficiencies and to be frustrated or to deviate, misled from the true way of the inner life and seeking into false paths, or to be left wandering about in an intermediate chaos of experiences and fail to find his way out into the true realization. So this is an inventory of our incapacities and the dangers that we meet if we insist on going in before we're truly ready. These perils were well known to a past spiritual experience and have been met by imposing the necessity of initiation, of discipline, of methods of purification and testing by ordeal, of an entire submission to the directions of the pathfinder or path leader, one who has realized the truth and himself possesses and is able to communicate the light, the experience, a guide who is strong to take by the hand and carry over difficult passages well as to instruct and point out the way. But even so, the dangers will be there and can only be surmounted if there is or there grows up a complete sincerity, a will for purity, a readiness for obedience to the truth, for surrender to the highest, a readiness to lose or to subject to a divine yoke the limiting and self-affirming ego. These things are the sign that the true will for realization, for conversion of the consciousness, for transformation is there. The necessary stage of the evolution has been reached. In that condition, the defects of nature which belong to the human being cannot be a permanent obstacle to the change from the mental to the spiritual status. The process may never be entirely easy, but the way will have been made open and practicable. The guide, the path, the requisite qualities, adhikara, all of these things are known to spiritual disciplines around the world, whether we go back to the Greeks and the Eleusinian mysteries, if we come into India and look at the Tantra. The requirements in the practice of the Kabbalah, the mysteries of Christianity, all have these criteria. To aspire, yes, but to aspire wisely. So we leave it here tonight. This is where we stop. We'll take up Sri Aurobindo's The Triple Transformation more next time. And of course, as we're reading here in The Life Divine, have a prolonged series of sessions with Sri Aurobindo's Letters on Yoga, in which he addresses the Triple Transformation, and you'll find even more material there, which will flesh out what he has written about here in a general philosophic way, just sort of an overview of what it means to transform the nature from the psyche and from the spiritual. It is most rewarding. So we close with Savitri. This time we're going to book 10, the book of the double twilight. We're in canto 3, the debate of love and death. Yet light is there. It stands at nature's doors. It holds a torch to lead the traveler in. It waits to be kindled in our secret cells. It is a star lighting an ignorant sea, a lamp upon our poop piercing the night. As knowledge grows, light flames up from within. It is a shining warrior in the mind, an eagle of dreams in the divining heart, an armor in the fight, a bow of God. Then larger dawns arrive, and wisdom's pomps cross through the being's dim, half-lighted fields. Philosophy climbs up thought's cloud-banked peaks, and science tears out nature's occult powers, enormous jinns who serve a dwarf's small needs, exposes the sealed minutiae of her art, and conquers her by her own captive force. On heights unreached by mind's most daring soar, upon a dangerous edge of failing time, the soul draws back into its deathless self. Man's knowledge becomes God's supernal ray. There is the mystic realm whence leaps the power whose fire burns in the eyes of seer and sage. A lightning flash of visionary sight, it plays upon an inward verge of mind. Thought silenced gazes into a brilliant void. A voice comes down from mystic unseen peaks. A cry of splendor from a mouth of storm. It is the voice that speaks to nights profound. It is the thunder and the flaming call. Above the plains that climb from nescient earth, a hand is lifted towards the invisible's realm, beyond the superconscient's blinding line, and plucks away the screens of the unknown. A spirit within looks into the eternal's eyes. It hears the word to which our hearts were deaf. It sees through the blaze in which our thoughts grew blind. It drinks from the naked breasts of glorious truth. It learns the secrets of eternity. Namaste, Jai Ma.